From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we'll explore the world of the highly acclaimed but ratings-challenged TV show Arrested Development. Now in its third season, the sitcom has gotten several Emmys and consistently high marks from critics, but it does not draw big audiences. We'll talk with series creator Mitchell Hurwitz. Also, Henry Winkler joins us. He played a recurring character during the first two seasons of Arrested Development, and he's now playing a doctor on the new CBS sitcom Out of Practice. But most people still know him as the Fonz, Arthur Fonzarelli, from the classic TV show Happy Days. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Tulip and the Pope by Deborah Larson. It's the author's memoir of her convent years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Mitchell Hurwitz, is the creator of the very non-traditional Fox sitcom, Arrested Development. The show is in its third season now, and returns with new episodes starting Monday, after being preempted by postseason baseball. Arrested Development hasn't drawn a large audience yet, but it has earned lots of praise and awards. For its first season, it won the Emmy as Outstanding Comedy. For its second season, it won for Best Comedy Series Writing. The show stars Jason Bateman as Michael Bluth, the only sane person in a family of eccentrics, egomaniacs, self-deluded showbiz wannabes, embezzlers, and adulterers. Bateman's co-stars include Jeffrey Tambor as the family patriarch who was sent to prison for his illegal dealings in the construction industry. Tambor also plays his less evil twin brother. Jessica Walter plays the family matriarch, who makes Leona Helmsley look tame, and Michael's siblings and in-laws are played just as wonderfully by such quirky actors as David Cross, Tony Hale, Will Arnett, and Portia de Rossi. Arrested Development is fast-paced, very dry, and extremely funny. Here's a scene from the pilot, when Jason Bateman, as Michael, confronts the rest of the family with some bad news.
Okay, guys, they are going to keep Dad in prison at least until this gets all sorted out. Also, the attorney said that they're going to have to put a halt on the company's expense account. Interesting, I would have expected that after they're keeping Dad in jail.
You know, Michael, Dad did name Mom as his successor. And I'm putting Buster in charge.
It's a good choice.
Buster? The guy who thought that the blue on the map was land?
He's had business classes.
Wait. 18th century agrarian business, but I guess it's all the same principles. Let me ask you, are you at all concerned about an uprising?
Okay, that's it. I'm done. I'm sick and tired of the greed and the selfishness and all the taking. Forget it. I got a son to think about. And you know, Lindsay, by the way, I expected this from them because they're completely oblivious. But you should know better.
When Mitchell Hurwitz went on stage in September to accept his latest Emmy for Arrested Development, he vented his frustration, with typical sharp-edged humor, at his show's inability to draw a large audience. "The Academy has twice rewarded us," he told the TV viewers at home, "for something you people won't watch." When I spoke to Mitchell Hurwitz, I began with the ratings for Arrested Development. I actually think of Arrested Development. I've been a TV critic for so long. I remember the first year of Cheers, where at one point in its first season, it was the lowest-rated program in all of television.
And yeah, I remember that.
And it was such a great show, and you just had to say there's nothing wrong with the people making the show, there's nothing wrong with the show, there's something wrong with the audience finding it, and I sort of feel that about Arrested Development. And I'm on the outside. What do you feel like?
Well, there's
inside?
A great deal wrong with us, personally, there's a lot of drinking. I think that's a negative. You know, there are many theories on why this doesn't have a bigger audience. There was so much initial positive press that very generously said that it was a smart show, which is a very nice thing to say. But I think it may have put people off and made them feel like, well, I don't want to be preached to, or I don't want to watch something that's unfunny and subtle. And really, you know, our delivery on this show is very dry. The stories themselves and the comedy itself is very broad. So I have always felt that we do have the right combination to get a big audience, but it just, for whatever reason, hasn't hit that zeitgeist and hasn't been promoted in such a way that people understand what we're selling here.
The show is almost always described as smart, but it's also dense.
Yes, it's dense. Well, listen, you know, I mean, it's funny. One of the things that has been one of the joys of doing the show is filling out the details. It has been just a hallmark of the show for some reason. And I think it's because myself and the other writers all come from situation comedy. And in situation comedy, you know, you're working in front of an audience, you're getting laughs, but you're only really able to get 3 laughs per page. And we've all done that for a while, and this has really been an opportunity to just pack in as much comedy as we can because we don't have to hold for laughs. But, you know, the hope is that we can tell stories about characters that aren't stock characters by showing, you know, the inconsistencies within the character. Whereas in situation comedy, oftentimes you can only tell one one story, a character just becomes a dumb character or a greedy character or a selfish character. And hopefully these characters are more nuanced, although just as absurd.
If I understand this right, Ron Howard not only narrates it and is an executive producer, but it was his idea to film using handheld digital video cameras.
That's
is that
right.
true?
It is. He definitely was the visionary behind this whole thing. He wanted to do, he had done both as a producer and as an actor, both single camera television shows, which are shows that are shot like a movie, and multi-camera shows, which are shows that are shot like a bad movie, I guess you would say. They're shot like a sitcom with several cameras shooting the action all at once in a three-walled set. And his feeling was that, you know, the comedy was sharper on the multi-camera shows, the sitcoms, because there was time to vet the comedy, there were run-throughs, and you got a number of takes at it. And in film, you know, there's so much time spent lighting and putting together the technical package that when you finally get a chance to do the takes, you really only have time to do two or three takes. And, you know, he kind of was aware of this new technology, this 24p, which is 24, I guess, per second, 24 frames per second videotape, which looks very much like film, doesn't require extensive lighting, and, you know, uses kind of the vocabulary of shows like Cops or Blind Date or some of the
There's
you know,
something
reality
to shoot
shows.
For.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, the savings was going to be in rehearsal and in run-through. And in effect, that is basically what we have today. You know, we don't have a formalized rehearsal period. But if we get on a set at 8 o'clock, we're up and lit and ready to shoot at 8:10. And, you know, you can run the scene 14 or 15 times. And that's really where the comedy comes from. And particularly in a family piece, you know, that's where people really start to interact and overlap and learn each other's rhythms.
There are plenty of inside jokes in this show.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering...
It's very self-referential, in a way.
Well, there are some that... For example, one of the easiest ones is you always end the show with next on Arrested Development and have cast members act out things that never happen.
That don't happen,
I don't know that that's ever happened before in television. How did that idea come about?
Maybe that's not working for us. You know where that came from? The question they ask when they test these pilots, you know, there's an enormous amount of testing they do on pilots before they decide which ones to put on their schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main questions is, would you like to see this again next week? So I just thought it would be funny to kind of trick them and say, here's what's going to happen next week, right before they were asked that question. And, you know, it worked to a certain extent. And then we found, you know, this is a great way to wrap up stories and get a couple extra jokes in and... You know, you get to end on a big laugh, whereas if you didn't have it, maybe you'd have to end on like a sort of clever piece of dialogue. And it has become just a really fun part of the show, but also a really onerous part of the show, because we'll get done writing the scripts and then say, oh, now we got to write the next on, which is never going to happen. Look, the tough thing about this show is that it does reward those who pay attention. And my feeling has always been that there is a market for that kind of thing. I know I'm that kind of TV viewer. I love studying The Sopranos and Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Office, you know, both the British and the American one. And so The Office has a very different tempo, obviously, than this show. So, you know, in a funny way, we often feel that we're really making a show for the new technology here. We're making a show for TiVo, and we're making a show for DVD, and it really becomes, you know, part of our objective in making this thing. Particularly now that we see that, all right, these numbers are kind of staying where they are, and yet the DVDs appear to be selling pretty well. So it becomes this new challenge. Whereas when I started writing television, much of it was disposable. There is kind of the feeling that this might stick around for a while. So we're encouraged to put as much in as we can while they're giving us the keys to the building, you know.
Mitchell Hurwitz, creator and executive producer of the Fox TV series Arrested Development. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Mitchell Hurwitz, creator of the TV sitcom Arrested Development. The show's abbreviated third season returns on Monday. Mitchell Hurwitz, your TV your credits are pretty limited, but they start with a hit. I mean, Golden Girls, I think, is the first thing that you're credited as doing.
Yeah, that was amazing fortune for me.
So how did you get that job, and what did you learn there?
You know, I got that job the way I advise many people who want to break into this business to get a job. And I started working at the production company as a runner, which is like a gopher, really, and picked up the coffee and delivered the scripts for Paul Witt and Tony Thomas, who ran Witt Thomas Harris Productions. And they produced The Golden Girls. And I spent about a year and a half with them and worked with them personally kind of became a type of assistant for them, and, you know, was writing in the meantime, and had been writing since high school and before, obviously, but I really learned the business that way and used that connection to get my scripts read. There are many ways to do it. Many people come out and just write what are called spec scripts or speculative mm-hmm. scripts for episodes, for shows that already exist. And, you know, hope to find an agent and use contacts and that kind of thing. This happened to be the way I did it, by getting to know the people involved.
But how do you go from here's your coffee to here's my script when you're handing
them
things?
You know, those are tough years. Those are really, for me anyway, they were very anxious years. And I just kept writing and more than anything kept learning and getting better. And, you know, by developing relationships with these people, and it works this way for me now with the people that work on my show, I'm more inclined to read a script of someone who's been working on the show and has been giving themselves to it than I would just to pick a script off a pile or read an agent submission. So, you know, at least for my way of thinking, that has been a more effective way to get into the business. And, you know, I'd turn in these scripts and ask people to read them, and at a certain point in my development, they were impressed enough to let me write an outside script, and then from there get into a staff writing position, which is what happened on The Golden Girls, and then, you know, you sort of rise through the ranks. I had developed a very strong relationship with Paul Witt and Tony Thomas, and they were, you know, unbelievably generous with me and put me in what they call a show running position early on. In fact, right after The Golden Girls. The Golden Girls spinoff, Golden Palace, which is often confused with the Chinese takeout place. And that was maybe the funniest thing about the show.
Now, excuse me if I have this wrong, but Golden Palace, didn't Mark Cherry of Desperate Housewives work on that as well?
You know, I'm not speaking to Mark Cherry. I'm extremely resentful. And I want to make that very clear. Yes, Mark and I worked together on The Golden Girls. Mark is a very good friend, actually, and then we did Golden Palace together, and you know, we both had similar kind of roads. We both kind of knocked around for a while, you know, Mark was always so talented. We sort of had no doubt that he would be successful. But you know, you need a lot of luck too.
Well, he's appeared in your show, so obviously,
yes,
guys are still at least cordial.
The children picketed Mark Cherry's house. The children picketed for, you know, keep sex within marriage.
On the show, we should say.
On the show.
Yes.
Yes, they picketed. And he came and he poked out his window and yelled, "It's a satire."
Well, what was it like?
Cameo.
What was it like this year when you won the Emmy for best writing in a comedy and you beat out Mark Cherry for a Desperate Housewives pilot?
Well, that was, I mean, obviously it was very surprising, and we didn't expect that to happen. And if anything, it was, you know, we just saw it as a promotional opportunity and focused on that. It was, you know, I feel that the Academy and the critics have been very generous towards us because they want to encourage risk-taking television, which seems to be happening more and more, by the way, that there does seem to be more risk-taking in primetime television. But I've always felt that we're the beneficiaries of that goodwill. And I think that might have been an example of that, where the Academy felt like, you know, they've got enough rewards over at Desperate Housewives. Let's do what we can to keep the show on the air. And I think it did keep the show on the air.
But since you and Mark worked together in the trenches, what did you say to each other afterward?
I, you know, mocked him, and I poked his belly with the Emmy, No, he was very happy for me, and I was, of course,
I'm sorry you said no.
For me.
I liked that image, by the way.
Oh no, he's a great guy. He was so supportive, and you know, the only loss was that we were so sure that Mark was going to win the Emmy that we had actually written a scene where Mark Cherry, the character that has appeared in our show, sued the Bluth Company for building a faulty house that he bought, and the image was going to be Mark Cherry putting his Emmy on the mantle and the Emmy crashing to the floor as the mantle gave way. So I really wanted to do that gag and poke fun of ourselves for losing the Emmy, but then we won it.
Ruined a good joke.
Yeah, we lost a good joke.
We're talking with Mitchell Hurwitz, the creator of Arrested Development. This isn't the first time that Fox has given a somewhat shortened season order. When they did it to you the first time and cut you back from 22 to 18, that ended up on the air somehow. Can you talk about that and how that was received internally?
That was a little seditious. But, you know, we made fun of ourselves, too, because we're legendarily behind on scripts. You know, I'll turn in the script at 3 o'clock in the morning that's going to start shooting at 7 that morning. So we had just gotten the cutback from 22 to 18, and coincidentally, we were looking for a device to say that their business was in peril, the Bluth Company housing business was in peril.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what seemed the obvious thing to say was that they had, you know, sold this order for 22 houses, and they just found out that it had been cut back to 18 houses. And every time someone said that, you know, another character would say, "Those bastards." we called ourselves on it, too, because Jason, the Michael character, was on the phone saying, you know, "This is outrageous. You know, we were commissioned for 22 houses. You cut it back to 18. We had the plans drawn up and everything." And that's, we had Ron Howard say, "Actually, that part wasn't true. But they would have gotten them done on time. They always had." So, you know, we were at least saying, "Listen, we're not prepared either. But we would have made it."
And what was the Fox reaction when they first saw that or saw the scripts?
They thought it was funny. You know, they're great. They really, Gail Verman was there at the time, and she was such a fan of the show and such a supporter of the show. And now we've got Peter Liguori there, and he's, you know, the same thing. I mean, I really do believe that Fox has desperately wanted this show to work. They have really supported it. I, you know, would say that the promotional effort has not been as effective as it could have been, but it is not for their lack of wanting it to work. I think for whatever reason, they've decided they don't want to allocate the funds to the promotion of this show, but rather will give those funds to the production of this show. And you know what? I'll take it.
And then, Mitchell, my final question sort of puts on my other hat of being a TV critic as well. One of the things that's so much fun about watching Arrested Development is how much it rewards people who have watched a lot of television, that there are so many TV jokes and TV performers who come in, and just the Ron Howard, Andy Griffith jokes that keep going back and forth.
Yeah. Isn't that fun? We had Henry Winkler jump the shark in one of the shows. The shark, they found a shark that they thought had bit off Buster's hand, but it wasn't, in fact, you know, the right animal. So he said, well, and it was actually the episode where we were asked to mention Burger King, which was kind of a jump the shark moment, to use the television nomenclature. So Henry Winkler said, "Well, I'm going to Burger King," and jumped over a shark.
But you guys are not like anti-TV snobs that are doing a different type of television to be better than television. You are people who came from television
not.
And are sort of, I don't know, glorifying in it.
I hope so. I mean, it really is, you know, there is nothing mean-spirited about it. I mean, we do come from this, and we were raised with this, and you know, it is a big part of our culture. And we, you know, look, it's so great having Ron Howard's voice on this thing, because we've heard this voice for 30 years. So, you know, what fun to be able to mention Andy Griffith. In fact, in one episode, that maybe the episode you're talking about, they had hired Andy Griffith to sit behind them in the courtroom and kind of look like Matlock. And he saw the dressing room that they'd given him and split. In fact, he was supposed to be on the show, but we couldn't get him out in time, so we had to rewrite it. But he saw the dressing room and left. And the line we gave, I guess, Lindsay was, he thought we were making fun of him. And suddenly the narrator speaks up and says, "Nobody was making fun of Andy Griffith. I can't emphasize that enough." So
yeah.
There is, you know, this deference that Ron was paying to Andy, which is kind of fun.
Well, Mitchell Hurwitz, I hope you have many more years of writing and doing this sort of stuff on Arrested Development. Thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, David. This is really fun.
Mitchell Hurwitz, creator of the TV sitcom Arrested Development. Here's a taste from the current season, in which Jeffrey Tambor and Jason Bateman, as father George Bluth Sr. and son Michael Bluth, are discussing possible courtroom tactics in the father's upcoming trial.
Now listen, we can't just go in there and plead not guilty. We have to have someone big behind us, our own private Matlock. So I made some calls and I got him.
Got who?
Andy Griffith. Yeah, you never saw Matlock.
Not a real attorney, Dad.
Now for $10,000, he'll actually sit behind us in court and read the paper. For $15,000, he'll actually sit at the defense table. For $20,000, he'll twice lean forward and whisper something in your ear. Oh, white suit, that's extra.
Well, that's an awful lot of money for the stupidest idea I've ever heard.
The juries love him.
That's just it, Dad. There won't be a jury because we are pleading guilty.
I am not guilty. Oh, I didn't want to tell you this. Are you ready for the bombshell?
Andy Griffith wasn't the bombshell?
I'm a patsy. I was set up by the Brits. A group of British builders operating outside the OC contacted me for a partnership to build homes overseas. I did not know they meant Iraq.
We've got a picture of you with Saddam Hussein.
I thought that was the guy who played the soup Nazi.
Come on.
I told him how much I liked his work.
Arrested Development returns to the Fox schedule on Monday. Seasons 1 and 2 are both available on DVD. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging everyone to maintain their brain. Brain health tips at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Life After Leather. We'll talk to Henry Winkler, who attained pop icon status as the black-jacketed Fonzie on the TV show Happy Days. He's now playing a doctor on the new CBS sitcom Out of Practice. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the memoirs of a former nun. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is Henry Winkler, who, coincidentally, worked with our previous guest, Mitchell Hurwitz, on Arrested Development. He played the recurring role of Barry, the Bluth family lawyer. This season, he gave that up to play a doctor, Stuart Barnes, one of many doctors on Out of Practice, a new CBS sitcom. Stuart's ex-wife Lydia, played by Stockard Channing, is a doctor. So are their three grown children, played by Paula Marshall, Ty Burrell, and Christopher Gorham. Only Stuart's new girlfriend, Crystal, played by Jennifer Tilly, isn't a doctor. But as we learn in this conversation between Stuart and his sons, he manages to confuse his girlfriend and ex-wife anyway.
We were talking, and I was drifting off to sleep, and Crystal said, "Good night, Stuart," and I said, "Good night, Lydia." Well, you know, she was upset, and so we talked about it, and then I went back to sleep, and apparently she was still talking about it.
Oh,
Bet she woke you up after that.
Well, no. Technically, the floor woke me up. But anyway, you know, it's nothing that, like, a really fancy dinner and a few well-timed man tears can't fix.
In addition to his current role on Out of Practice, Henry Winkler's resume includes the role of the washed-up football coach who inspires Adam Sandler to become a gridiron star in the movie The Waterboy, a supporting role in Sandler's next movie, called Click, and a credit as one of the producers of the 1985-92 adventure series MacGyver, about a man who used his wits rather than weapons and used available materials to invent his way out of tight fixes. Winkler's most famous credit by far, though, is as the Fonz. Arthur Fonzarelli, the leather-jacketed babe magnet on Happy Days, that nostalgic sitcom about teenagers growing up in the innocent 1950s. When the show premiered in 1974, the Fonz was a bit part. Before long, though, he was the comic centerpiece, and over the 10-year run of the show, became a full-fledged TV icon. The Fonz exuded a confident charm and cocky swagger that he expected to work on every woman who saw him, and even on those who only heard him.
You, Cunningham residents. No, Richie ain't here right now. Oh, because he and his family went off on a little vacation joint, you know. Hey, you sound very adorable. What's your name? Mary, how are you? Arthur Fonzarelli here, house sitter.
You never heard of me? What are you, new in town? You just back from lunch.
The Fonzie jacket is in the Smithsonian.
Yes.
Is that unveiled like a star on Hollywood Boulevard? I mean, do you go there when it's...
Yes, you do. I brought it to the museum. And I brought it to the museum with my wife and with my parents. My parents came to America having escaped Nazi Germany. And now they are watching their son present a jacket to the Museum of America.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to tell you, if that is not a journey, I don't know what is.
So have you been back since?
I have.
And what's it like? And what's it like when you go back there? What are you next to?
Archie's chair.
Mm-hmm.
Dorothy's shoes, I think, are in there. And then, of course, now my lunchbox is in there, so I'm represented twice. And I have to tell you something. It's one of the unbelievably great moments in my life, let alone career.
It's got to be. It's also got to be a little bit surrealistic to think that a television show, when that part began, was just a one-shot. Ended up in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, it is truly amazing. When I go anywhere in the world, people invite me physically into their homes for dinner. No matter what language, whether I speak the language or not, we were in 126 countries. And they all treat me with such unbelievably warm feelings. It's a gift, actually, I have to say.
The break that you got and the way
it was
that...
was enormous, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the way that role exploded was a fascinating part of the 70s. But part of it is due to, I think, Gary Marshall allowing you to keep that part growing.
Yeah, everybody. I mean, even Ron, who was the star of the show, we had a conversation only once about it. It was the fourth year. We were driving in his Volkswagen Bug back from location where we would do the opening episodes of the show. We were always on location for a new season. And I said, "So how are you feeling?" And he said, "Look, it's good for the show. You didn't do anything out of the ordinary to make this happen to you. You didn't go and try to promote yourself. You just are. And you've always been respectful and loving to me. And that's how I feel." And we never spoke about it again.
And what was Gary Marshall like to work for? Is he as funny when you have to work for him as he is when you interview him?
I've tried since 1974. I have tried to describe all of Gary Marshall.
And I'm realizing that it is almost impossible. He is my Don. He is my teacher. He is very funny and very zany. And he is very strict with enormous and powerful boundaries.
Really?
Yes.
What kinds of boundaries?
I'll tell you. I had to make a personal appearance in Arkansas. We were doing the show on a Friday night. I was about to catch a plane to fly to Arkansas to make my first appearance. I was going to be paid $1,000 to sign autographs in a mall. And I went to him when he was, he was introducing the guest cast on the show at the end of the taping.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Gary and I said, Gary, can we hurry up a little bit because I've got to catch a plane? And he smiled at me. And then he finished. He put the microphone down. He came over to me. He grabbed me and held me against the wall. And he said, look, your guest cast has every right to be introduced as much as you do. Don't ever interrupt me again. I said, absolutely,
wow.
I won't. I don't know what I was thinking. I am a silly person. But that's how I learned to be an executive producer. He is a friend. He is your father. He is your brother. He is your leader. He listens. He would come into the, he would come onto the set if I had a problem with a joke. And he would go, well, you know, you could do it this way. And he would tilt his head. And 55 solutions would fall off the top of it. And then you had the problem of now picking, because they all worked.
Uh-huh.
Which one were you going to choose? Just an extraordinary man, period.
And have you figured out after all this time or added to what was your understanding of what made the part so popular?
You know, I don't know. This is what I know. I played him with a sense of loyalty. I played him with a sense of vulnerability. I said to the producers when I first met them, when I first auditioned for the job, being the shortest actor in the room, everybody was famous and tall and was named Chad. and Henry, hello, nice to see you. Henry's here. And I said, look, if you let me show the other side, when he takes his leather jacket off at home, who does he have to be cool for? You let me show that side also, it will be my pleasure. And they said yes, and I said yes. And I got it on my 27th birthday.
And at the time, he was supposed to be about how old?
He was 18. I was the oldest teenager in captivity. But also, on the other hand, the age was incredible because I was able to handle what started to come at me a little bit better. Can you imagine if I was only 18? I would be dead now.
Mm-hmm.
It was enormous.
Henry Winkler, whose career as a TV sitcom star has spanned three decades, from Happy Days in the 70s to Out of Practice today. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with Henry Winkler. He's one of the stars of the current CBS sitcom Out of Practice and became a TV icon playing Arthur Fonzarelli on Happy Days. I want to switch gears and ask about your early production credit because
sure.
I thought that the first time that you took the muscle that you had from the stardom of the Fonz and put it into production, you made a very unusual choice. Who are the DeBolts is what I'm thinking
And where
of.
They get 19 kids?
Yes.
Describe
that.
That
for
was
people.
It was a documentary that won the Oscar. It is about a family that lived in Piedmont, California. Dorothy and Bob. Dorothy and Bob had four very healthy, wonderful kids. And somehow it got into their need and their personality and their mind to adopt 19 children, every one of whom had a disability in some way. And then they brought them into their home. They became their family. And these 19 kids were all mainstreamed, no matter what the disability. It was the most life-affirming, the most positive, the most affecting group of people I ever have spent time with.
Now, Jenner, almost 30 years later, it looks almost like a prototypical, perfect, affirming reality TV concept. How did that come about as your first production credit?
They couldn't get it on TV. Here it had won the Oscar, and nobody would take it and put it on television. So I went to a Board of Trustees dinner for ABC. And when everyone had their second glass of wine, I went from table to table to president of each division of ABC. And I said, look, I have this documentary. If you watch it and you are not as moved as I am, if you are not as joyful at the end of it as I am, I'll walk away. Otherwise, I promise you I will get great promotion, and will you put it on the air? And Tony Thomopoulos said yes. And then I went to Paul Newman, Clint Eastwood, Burt Reynolds, John Ritter. And I said, look at this. If you're not as moved as I am, I'm sorry I took 74 minutes of your time. If you are, I'm going to ask you to make a commercial for television, because otherwise I won't be able to get it on ABC. Every man said yes. And they all made a commercial for Who Are the DeBolts? And it went on to win an Emmy.
Another production credit people might be surprised to know is yours. I'm sort of delighted by this, is MacGyver.
Right. John Rich, a television director, he directed most of all in the family. He was a great comedy director. He and I formed a company, Winkler Rich, and one of our very first productions was MacGyver. And ABC put it on, and they moved it to every single day of the week, and the audience followed it. Until finally it was on Monday nights after football. No other show has ever done as well after Monday Night Football again. And we were on for 7 years with Richard Dean Anderson, one of the greats. And we had quite a team, quite a team. And finding those MacGyverisms might have been, I'm not kidding, worse than looking for diamonds.
Do you have a favorite?
I do. I do. He's driving a Jeep. It's shot up. The radiator now is spilling all of the water. He drops eggs into the radiator. They hard boil. They fill the holes. And he continues and gets away. Isn't that great?
That is great. What was he doing with eggs?
Yet I don't know. He's a very healthy guy. He would suck raw eggs, and it would give him energy. Very, very health conscious.
I've got a question that goes back quite a way, and I don't know if it predates your decision to go into acting or not. Mm. When were you diagnosed as having dyslexia?
My stepson, Jed Weitzman, was in the third grade. I took him to see the American Indians because... he was studying the native life and tradition of the Hopi. We went to Arizona. We went to the Mesa. He stood behind me. And from 7 in the morning until 9 at night, he spoke into my ear as I drove across Arizona. He was interesting. He was funny. I could never say, "Will you shut up?"
Mm-hmm.
When we got home and he wrote a report, it was one sentence. It was smudged. He erased a hole right through the paper. We took him and had him tested. Everything they said to him, I went, oh my gosh, that's me. That's exactly me. And when I was 31, when my stepson was in the third grade, I found out that I wasn't stupid. I wasn't lazy. and I wasn't not living up to my potential.
That's amazing that you discovered that so late.
Yeah. And let me tell you that first, you have a lot of anger, because all of those arguments, all of that name-calling, all of those punishments were for naught, because children, one out of five kids has some sort of learning challenge. And what is so important for the parent to tell the child is that it does not matter that you learn differently. All that you have to know is that you do somewhere in you have greatness, and your job is to figure out what that is and give it to the world as a gift.
Well, Henry, how did you have the drive to go into acting, knowing full well that it would require the fast turnaround of reading in order to memorize your lines?
That's a great question. My desire, my need to be an actor was, I didn't think about it. I didn't decide it. It just lived in me. Then I had to figure, okay, now I've picked a profession that is totally based on reading. And then as a producer, you have to read a lot. You know, every book that I own is in hardcover and on the shelf so I can see it, because every book that I've read is a triumph. I mean, they are my awards. I'm not kidding.
And I would think it's also a triumph for a dyslexic to not only read books, but to write them.
Well, that I have to say, I have this amazing partner, Lynn Oliver. We have written 9 novels called Hank Zipser, The World's Greatest Underachiever. They're about my life as a dyslexic, and I took from all parts of my life the emotion of where it got me in trouble, I put into this fourth grader who has just in the 9th novel graduated into the 5th grade. But we make them funny first. It's not, woe is me, you know, oh, I got a problem. He has a hard time, and he has great friends, and he's resourceful. And the great thing is, letters. I get letters from kids all over the country. One of the things that they love, after that it makes them laugh out loud, is that he's resourceful, that he figures out there's another way to beat the problem.
It's MacGyver.
I guess so. I never put that together. That makes a lot of sense to me. You know, MacGyver had to take what he had and make it into something. And people with learning challenges do that. They take the same exact thing that other people use and they use it to their own end and somehow change the nature of an object so that it works.
Was it an especially proud moment when you got your first copy of your own book?
I was at a lunch in New York City. Penguin Putnam is my publisher. We were sitting at the table and they invited for me to meet all of the book buyers for Barnes & Noble in the children's section from the different from different states.
Mm-hmm.
We're in an Italian restaurant. Everybody's got the book in front of them. I could not speak. I picked the book up. I held it in my hand. I rubbed it. I smelled it. I touched it to my face. I turned it over and over. I couldn't believe that this thing existed and I was part of it.
So who are your fans today?
Who are my fans? Wow. Well, I walk down the street in New York City and a father holding his daughter's hand said, "Oh, that's Henry Winkler. He played the Fonz."
Mm-hmm.
And the daughter said, I don't know what the Fonz is, but he wrote a book I read. And I think that at that moment, I understood what heaven was.
Well, Henry Winkler, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Henry Winkler, one of the stars of the CBS sitcom Out of Practice, which airs on Mondays. The new Adam Sandler film featuring Winkler, called Click, will be released next year. This is Fresh Air. Deborah Larson's best-selling historical novel, The White, was based on the true account of a young woman named Mary Jemison, who was taken captive by Indians in the 18th century. Larson's new memoir, called The Tulip and the Pope, explores the situation of another young woman, Larson herself, who spirited off into a different kind of extreme solitude. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Last fall, my Catholic grammar school in Queens, New York, held a reunion for everyone who'd graduated since the school was founded in 1962. 8 of my far-flung classmates from the class of 1969 showed up, as well as 2 of my former teachers, both of them still nuns. Talking with these devoted teachers and looking them in the eye, probably for the first time ever, confirmed what I'd suspected in the decades since I graduated. These nuns, like most of my other teachers throughout grammar school, were at most maybe 15 years older than I. When they were teaching me, many of these women were only in their mid-20s. They were so very young to have already committed themselves to the religious life. Deborah Larson was one of that generation of nuns who joined the convent when religious vocations in America and parochial school construction were at an all-time high. She entered the Order of the Sisters of Charity in 1960 when she was just 19 years old. In The Tulip and the Pope, her evocative and intelligent memoir of her convent years, Larson says of herself and her fellow novices, "Our hair shone, our eyes shone. Most of us were not long out of the womb." The memoir opens on a comic scene where Larson and 2 other young women sit in a yellow cab outside the mother house of the Sisters of Charity in East Dubuque, Illinois, smoking their last cigarettes. Once these raw recruits walk through the convent doors to be admitted as postulants, they'll be stripped of their civilian clothes, secular names, and eventually their hair. Contact with family will be severely restricted. Larson recalls how letters from her parents were slit open by the mother superior and censored. The postulants will school themselves in silence, as well as something called custody of the eyes, a practice in which they constantly look downward, lest they become distracted from the meditative state by colors or shapes or the gaze of another person. Collectively, their sense of touch will atrophy because touching, whether of one's own body or another person's, is forbidden. As Larson describes it, that first year in the convent is like a very slow amputation. By the end of that probationary period, all that will remain of these idealistic young women will be their brains and souls. In her stark historical novel, The White, Larson carried readers off into the wilderness of the 18th century. The Tulip and the Pope affects a similar miracle of time travel. Larson summons up a lost world of pre-Vatican II Catholicism, a world of deference, incense, and conviction, which will be familiar to Catholic readers of a certain vintage and of fascination to any reader curious about religious faith and the stony places it sometimes leads its followers. Writing at a 40-year remove from her convent experience, Larson, who's still a spiritual person but no longer an observant Catholic, teases out the attractions the religious life once held for her and recounts how her vocation eroded as the opportunities opened up by the Catholic progressive movement in the mid-1960s began to tempt her away. Most of the chapters in The Tulip and the Pope are short, some less than a page, and as their titles suggest, they read like prose poems on religion and its occasional absurdities. Black Becomes Us, Joan of Arc's Kneecaps, Gregorian Chant and the Congo, Pajama Legs. Larson often writes in soliloquies, the kind of soliloquies that must have been running in her head while she was in the convent, so that we readers are in the position of overhearing her dialogues between self and soul. Recalling the convent's ban on books, Larson says, "Surely you can do without your very own books for the rest of your life, can't you? You can do without the ones you fall asleep with, the ones that smell like a pulp mill or like mildew, or the ones that smell like Belgian linen." Ultimately, Larson couldn't do without those books, nor could she do without the particular friendships the convent forbade, nor cigarettes, nor colorful clothes, nor, in short, the wider world. Without disparaging or sentimentalizing the convent that once was her life, Larson conveys its drowsy power. much like my old Catholic grammar school, which, according to neighborhood gossip, just escaped being placed on the Cardinal's most recent list of schools to be closed in this era of downsizing, the convent is for Larson an enduring site of longing and dismay.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of a new memoir called Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed The Tulip and the Pope by Deborah Larson. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Image Entertainment, presenting Bill Maher, I'm Swiss. Political satirist Bill Maher takes a funny look at American life on DVD November 1st. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
If I were a rich man,
Fiddler on the Roof has never been more fabulous. Rosie O'Donnell now stars with Harvey Fierstein in the current Broadway revival. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Fiddler lyricist Sheldon Harnick and composer Jerry Bock. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
If I were a bitty rich, a idle diddle, idle diddle man. Ah.